stop it and see if it's taped anything. Talk to me again.
Okay.
The tape recorder works. Okay. Let's see. Today is Wednesday, October 6th, 1999, and I have the great pleasure of speaking with Ann DeMarco of the famous DeMarco Sisters singing group. Ann, when did you and your sisters first begin singing together?
We began singing together, three of us. We were 2, 4, and 6 years old.
And what?
We were a trio.
What caused you to sing together?
My
did you
father,
do it on your own, or was it your parents?
No, my father. He was a singer, and he played banjo and guitar and all, but didn't read a note of music. By the way, none of us ever did either.
Well, I understand Irving Berlin didn't either.
Not right. And that's who helped put us on the Fred Allen Show.
Irving Berlin.
Berlin, yes.
And you started to sing when you were 2, 4, and 5, did you say, or 6?
4 and 6. We were 2 years apart.
2, 4, and 6.
Right.
And you just sang at home, or did you start?
Yeah, my father taught us harmony. The first song he taught us was, "When it's springtime in the Rockies, I'll be coming back to you."
Uh-huh.
And he taught us each our parts, you know, and we listened. And to be sure we'd be on key, he had a Coca-Cola bottle, you know.
Right.
And he'd blow in it, you know. And we had to be sure that we ended on the same key that we started with, and we always did.
Now, how long did you do that before you started singing for other people?
We were, I think 7, 9, and 11 years old. My father took the trio to New York.
Right.
New York City. And he took us to Radio City Music Hall. We went on an excursion ticket. Somebody offered to pay for us. We were very poor, you know.
Right.
And we get there, and it was a weekend excursion, and we went to Radio City Music Hall, and there were all people in the lobby. My father said, "Sing." So, you know, but now we know. You know, we were kids. You know, we started to sing "The Object of My Affection" in three-part harmony.
This is in the lobby of the music hall.
The lobby. Of NBC. NBC.
Uh-huh. Radio City.
That was right across the street. Right.
Right.
And as we started singing, a man said, "Hey, get these kids upstairs, you know." And we went upstairs, you know, and the man made us sing, whoever he was, and then he says, "Come back in a month." So we said, "Well, we got to go back by Monday." You know, the excursion was only for the weekend or what, you know.
Where were you folks from?
Rome, New York.
Upstate.
Upstate, right.
Near Utica, right.
Near Utica, 15 miles, right.
Right.
So then we went back to Rome, you know.
Right.
And then, wait a minute. Then somebody said to us, "How about the Paul Whiteman Hour? They had the Paul Whiteman Show." You know, you remember Paul Whiteman?
Oh, yes, yes. Pops.
Right. And they put us on the Paul Whiteman Show. The three of us now.
You remember what year that was?
Yes, about in the 30s, but the late
30s.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So you sang on the Paul Whiteman Show. That was your first radio appearance?
The first radio appearance.
So Paul,
and from that, we went on Fred Allen's Town Hall Tonight. The trio.
Directly from Whiteman.
Yes, directly to Whiteman. And then they said, "We'll give him $250. My father said, "How many months?" And they said, "For the night." I swear to God, I'm not lying.
Your father must have been thrilled.
Oh, yeah. All right. So after that, we did the Fred Allen Show. When that was the night that Stuart Canem was on, the kid, the 12-year-old that played the violin, and that's what started the feud with Jack Benny.
The Bee.
Right. And that's the day we were on, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then we did everything from Pink and Pat to Hobby Lobby to Showboat. We did all of these shows, right?
Now, was the first time you appeared on Fred Allen, was it a single appearance? You weren't going to be...
Just
as a guest star.
Just as a guest.
You weren't regulars to begin with.
No.
And then you guessed it on other shows.
Right, and in 45 we did the Allen Show.
So you started...
I want to tell you how we were... by now we were 5. The other two were born.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Arlene and Terry.
Uh-huh.
Now we're 5 sisters.
And you're all singing together.
And my father taught us barbershop harmony, and then he liked the Merrimacks, and he said they'd do a thing with... He didn't know how to say fifths or whatever it is, which
right.
I still don't know, you know. And then he taught us to sing in modern, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he took us to New York again. No. We stayed in Brooklyn at some relatives' house, the distant relatives, right? My Aunt Bea and Uncle Joe. They weren't really my Aunt Bea and Uncle Joe, but we called them that, right?
They were family.
Right, they were family. And so then we went to... My father took us to New York again. Meanwhile, my father was suffering from a very bad liver ailment, you know.
Right.
And he said, "Dear God, I just want to live to see my 5 kids make good, and then I'll be happy to pass away." And he drew a beautiful picture of Jesus, you know. I never forget this.
Uh-huh.
As long as I live. Anyway, to make a long story short, he took us to, the Brill Building. We were going to get some free music or something, right?
Yeah, isn't the Brill Building, isn't that the place where the ASCAP works?
Yeah, no, the Brill Building. Yeah, I don't remember, but I know that that's where Irving Berlin's office was.
Right.
In the Brill Building. So we're there to get music or whatever, I forget. And we always said, we knew we were good. This is an awful thing to say, but we knew how good we were. You know, five little kids.
Uh-huh.
Right? So what we did...
Adorable little kids.
Well, I don't know something about that.
Adorable. I've seen pictures. Adorable.
Oh, thank you. Anyway, so we said anybody that's important, you know, we'll start to sing, right? So I swear to God, this is the truth. This guy with the brown jacket and tan leather pants came in with sunglasses in the elevator, right?
Yes.
We didn't know who he was, you know, and we wouldn't recognize him anyway. So we said, look, on the fire, and put on your old gray bonnet with the blue ribbon, you know, just to sing like that with the harmony. And when he went, oh, my God, he says, come with me. My name is Gordon Jenkins.
Oh, my gosh.
And he took us to Irving Berlin's office. And he said, Irving, you got to hear these kids. You won't believe it. And we did a little bit of that, and he went, oh, my goodness. And he says, oh, we got to do something, you know. And he was so nice. And we always called him Mr. Berlin, you know.
Uh-huh.
We were so impressed and everything. Anyway, he says, well, look, he says, kids, he said, were you rehearse or anything like that? You know, we had no arranger or anything at the time. But this lady did want to arrange for us. Her name was Grace Shannon. She arranged for, what the heck was the name of that big singer? Jimmy, what was the name of that singer the one that came out of the Army? He was a big singer. He had just gotten out of the Army or something. I forget the name. I don't think of it.
Baritone crooner?
Yeah, a crooner.
Doggone
it. Johnny something? Johnny Desmond.
Okay.
Johnny Desmond. Right? And she was going to arrange for us and all, like, for nothing. You know, no, she just thought we were so good.
Right.
And everyone said, where are you going to rehearse? And we said, I guess NOLA Studios. He said, no, you rehearse in one of my offices. Well, I paid NOLA Studios. Isn't that great?
Wonderful.
And so we did that. And, oh, I forgot to tell you. You know while the three of us were singing?
Right.
Somebody told Babe Ruth about us. You know, the baseball player?
Yeah.
No, we were such dumb kids. We were like 6, 8, and 10 years old. The trio now.
George Herman Ruth.
Oh, sure. I got a tape of us doing it with Babe Ruth.
Wow.
An audio.
Uh-huh.
Video.
A video, excuse me, video. So they said that we were Babe Ruth's proteges or something like that. Anyway, we did a song. He did a movie for Warner's Vitaphone movie.
Right.
And he put us in the picture. And they said, they call us the Bambinos, Babe's proteges, right?
Uh-huh.
And they said, here they are, the 3D Marcos, right? And we sang, the three of us, all dressed in baseball suits. I can bring that to show you when I see you, if you want to see it.
That's wonderful.
You know?
That's terrific.
And we sing, it happened on the beach, but the tree harmony with me playing guitar. All right? And he said, over the ether. In those days, they said, over the ether.
Your dad must have been so proud of you.
Right?
Your dad must have been so proud of you.
He certainly was. He certainly was. Then, to get back to the five of us, Irving Berlin said, he said, I want to put them in Annie Get Your Gun with Ethel Merman, right?
Uh-huh.
He went all the way to Albany to see Governor Lehman, who was the governor at the time. I mean, this can be attested to, and you can't ask Mr. Berlin, right?
I believe you.
He said, I've got five kids that are so great. He made us learn that, you know, doing the what comes naturally, you know, right?
Yeah, I remember that very well.
That's right, from Annie Get Your Gun, and Ethel Merman, and everybody. And Lehman said, Mr. Berlin, first of all, it's a pleasure. This is what he told us, Mr. Berlin. He said, first of all, it is a pleasure to meet you. I've enjoyed you hearing your song. He said, but we have a thing in New York that I can't do anything about called the Gehrig Society.
Child labor law.
G-E-H-R-I-N-G, right.
Uh-huh.
He said, and if I gave permission for these children to sing in Annie Get Your Gun, every mother and her child would be around, you know.
Right.
And that's against the child labor. You heard of the child. I don't know if you're old enough or young enough to remember the child labor law.
Yeah.
But that's what it was. So we couldn't get it, and he felt so bad. But he went to Albany to plead with the governor, okay? That was that. And then they talked about Al Goodman, who was the orchestra leader on Fred Allen.
Right.
And Berlin introduced us to Al Goodman. And Al Goodman called Fred Allen. He said, they want me to hear these five kids. But the Merrimacks were signed by William Morris.
Big agency. Did you have
No, we had no agency.
No agent.
We had a manager then picked us up, Jenny O'Connor, who was a drunk. But she signed the point. Anyway, he said to us, he said, he called Fred Allen. He said, I want to audition these five kids that Irving Berlin's raving about. And Fred Allen said to Al Goodman, he told us later, he said, if these kids are any good, then you book them. So I leave it up to you. You're the musical director.
Well, what happened? What happened to the to the Merrimacks?
They didn't get the show.
They lost it.
Yeah, well, they thought they were going to be on because they were William Morris, and so was the Fred Allen show.
Oh, I see.
Nobody.
They were not related to one another, the Merrimacks,
no.
Were they? They were just a group that got together.
Michael, two of them, I think, were brothers. They were very, very good. That's who my father patterned us after, you know.
Right.
Anyway, to make a long story short, we auditioned for. Oh, you want to hear? You got a minute?
I've got lots of minutes.
Okay, my father said, when we went to audition, my father was really sick by then, so the five of us made it to New York by ourselves. It took us 50 cents back and forth on the subway, nickel apiece.
Those were the days.
Those were the days, right?
A nickel beer and a nickel subway.
So my father said to us, he said, if you get the Fred Allen show, he says, call me up and say, burn the mattress. Now, I got to tell you what burn the mattress means. My father said that in Italy, where he was born, there was this man that always used to play the lottery. And he told his wife, he said, I got a hunch, Angelina, if I put our life savings on the lottery, I had a feeling on 9999 that we can just start all over again. He said, if you see me coming home in a carriage, right?
Yeah.
He said, burn the mattress. We'll start like anew, right?
Right.
So the guy goes to the lottery, the old Italian guy, and 9998 comes out, and he faints and falls on the ground, right? So the neighbors knew where he lived. Some neighbors that lived near him. And they said, oh, poor Giacomino. He said, oh, my God, he fainted. Let's take him home, you know. So they put him in the carriage. And the carriage is coming up the walk, right? And the wife saw it, and she burned the mattress.
Oh, boy.
And burned it. In other words, she thought him coming home in the carriage, he won the lottery, which he didn't. You got it?
I got it.
Come home in the carriage because he passed out because he lost the lottery.
Poor, poor fellow.
Right. So anyway,
no mattress that night.
So when we auditioned for the Fred Allen show, I'll come and says, kid, you got the job. So we called my father and we said, burn the mattress. He said, oh, don't say to my heart. And I said, no, we burn the mattress. And we got that. And we were on for 4 years, from 45 to 49.
Did you actually have a contract or was it a week-to-week situation?
No. I don't remember if we had a contract or not.
But you were on it.
I know is that, oh, yeah, we went to MCA. You know how? Basil Rathbone, remember him?
Oh, yes. Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes. He sent a note and says to MCA, and he said, for God's sake, help these talented kids.
Right.
And they signed us with MCA, right?
Now you're represented well.
Now we're represented well. Now we played the Copa with Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis in 51. Right?
How old are you at this time?
Oh, I don't remember. Young.
Teenagers still.
Teenagers, right.
Right.
And we were saying, you know, I'm late for a very important date, you know, from the Alice in Wonderland,
right.
Or whatever it was.
Right.
And unbeknownst to us, Joe Pasternak was in the audience. And he put us in a movie with Esther Williams called Skirts Ahoy.
Marvelous.
God bless him, right?
Absolutely. Was that the only movie you were in, or were you in others?
That was the only movie, yes.
Well, it was good enough, though. We were in a fine cast.
Right.
Metro-Golden-Mayer.
In other words, we weren't even part of the picture. We were too young to even be waves at the time, you know?
Right, right. But you were in the picture.
Yeah, we were in the picture. We sang, what good is a gal without a guy? Nice and Navy Ham and all. Quite a few things we did in there. We acted a little bit, but we weren't actresses. Matter of fact, the director, right, says, come in and say, we're the Williams sisters, right?
Right.
So we all came in with our suitcases, you know, with the recruiting thing, and we said, we're the Williams sisters. And he went, geez, you come in like a G.D. vaudeville act. We weren't actresses. Then we went, we're the Williams sisters. And he says, no, I can't hear you at all. Sidney Lanfield was the director. But we were one take with all the songs we did. He was proud of us for that.
Uh-huh.
That's all. And then what else we did? Then we did Ed Sullivan Show 26 times.
Nope.
And Ed Sullivan used to take us with him. We used to call him Uncle Ed and his wife Aunt Sylvia.
Uh-huh.
He'd take us to his apartment. He loved it. I got tapes of us on Ed Sullivan video. What did you... These are my paisanos. When they were first on the show, I had to take them out. I couldn't take them out for a drink. I had to give them ginger ale.
What did you girls do for school while you were performing?
We still went to school.
Went to school every day?
Still went to school, except that my two younger sisters went to professional school.
So we're
taking good care of. Don't I sound intelligent?
You sound very intelligent. I'm impressed.
Oh, I just say to impress you. Anyway, to make a long story short, we went from there to Fred Allen Show. I forgot to tell you this. When we first started singing as the five of us, now this you won't remember, but I do. My sister Arlene, who was the youngest, was 10 years old. We were 10, 12, 14, and 16. We were 10, 12, 14, 16, and 18, right?
Right.
And we made jazz recordings for Majestic Records. I wish I could get a hold of them. Jimmy Walker, who was the mayor of New York at the time, or former mayor, he wasn't the mayor then, you know.
Right, Bo James.
Was, right. He said, we did with Bud Freeman on saxophone, Billy Butterfield on trumpet, Ray McKinley on drums, I don't know who else, on piano, Teddy Wilson, it was a great jazz thing. I mean, Bud Freeman was so popular that when he died, his obituary was in Time magazine, so...
Right.
You know, he must have been somebody. I like our tapes of us singing that Chico Chico. You know, just kids, but all perfect harmony.
Uh-huh.
Right? That's what we did, too. And then came the Fred Allen Show in 45. So, up to that, it's been good. Then we played the Copa with Sinatra. I'll bring you a picture of us and Sinatra when I see you Saturday.
Right.
And we played the Copa with him, and he loved us, you know. He had a crush on my sister Gloria, who has since passed away.
Sounds like you've had a very exciting time.
Oh, yeah, it was good. And now my husband and I sing. We entertain at all the nursing homes, and they love us. We sing all the old songs.
Mm-hmm. What kind of memories do you have of Fred Allen as a personality?
He was very, very nice. And we called him Mr. Allen. He used to bring us spruce gum from Maine.
Right.
We'd go to church with him every Sunday, to St. Malachy's Church,
mm-hmm.
with him in Portland, and... Troy Aubrey Bogart took us to dinner. Ray Milland took us out to dinner. Charles Boyer played poker with us on the train. I think I told you that story.
Yeah, he won $500 and paid it back to you.
He gave it back. And then when I got back to the hotel, I said to the kids, they said, well, I only lost 30 and you only lost. I said, no, forget it. We're giving 100 apiece, the five of us, you know.
How about the others on the cast? Kenny Delmar, Minerva Pius, Parker Fennelly.
Kenny Delmar, Mrs. Delmar was very nice.
Right.
And Minerva Pius. Everybody loved us, you know. Matter of fact, when we started on the Fred Allen Show, they had to put a box on for my sister to reach the mic. That's when he said, it isn't so-and-so, kiddies.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you've heard it when we say, Mr. Allen, Mr. Allen.
Mr. Allen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It isn't so-and-so, kiddies, you know.
Right.
And let's see, 51, 52, 55 with Sinatra, and then we played a club. My sister met Keith Frizzell, the actor who has since passed away.
He played Eddie
Cantor. We had an argument. She left us and said, screw you all.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. You know.
That's a shame.
She broke up the act. We tried to get another lead, and we found Julie Stone, who was great. You know, Kirby Stone's wife.
Right.
And we had a job booked in Las Vegas. We're on the train, and she didn't show up, and we found out she had a miscarriage and all of that. And AGVA sued us, and we lost. They had their own kangaroo court. I mean, like, that was no excuse for not a lead. They said, well, mouth your records. I said, we don't have that many records to mouth, you know.
Right.
But we did record for Decca. You know who sent us to Decca? Bing Crosby.
Help
he was
me.
On the Fred Allen Show.
Uh-huh.
And he says, not Milt Gaber. We met him later, but it was somebody else who was in charge of Decca. And he says, help these kids.
Did you ever meet or work with any of the other sister groups, like the Andrews Sisters?
Oh, yeah.
And
as a matter of fact, the Andrews Sisters came to see us at the Copa. And we were such a big hit, we were embarrassed because they were our idols. We didn't like to show off in front of them.
How about the Dinning Sisters?
The Dinning Sisters were at our house in Brooklyn.
Right.
My mother ate macaroni for all of them.
And the Boswells?
The Boswells I never met, but I got in touch with... what was her name?
Connie?
No, not Connie. I forget. Well, anyway, I called her one time, you know,
right.
and she called me back.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And she said, oh, I just love the way you kids sing. Of course, by now they were much older, you know.
Right.
I think a couple of them were had gone. Anyway, she used to call all the time. And if I wasn't home, she'd talk with Jimmy on the phone. She'd never get off. She lived in Poughkeepsie.
Uh-huh.
I forget her name. It was an unusual name.
Right.
Like Connie, Beth, and... I don't know.
I've got it somewhere, but I don't have it nearby.
I'm not too young either, you know.
Yeah. And they were the Pickens sisters also.
Yeah.
They were probably before your time.
That was way before our time. But I remember the name, the Pickens sisters. I remember Jane Pickens used to do, look as we're walking, the telethon with Dennis James.
Right.
Who's also passed away, too.
And I guess things started to die down when in the 50s?
Yes.
Slow down a bit?
Right.
And that was when your sister left the group?
Right. In 58, I think. 57, 58.
What are your best memories about radio? Anything different about radio and TV, or anything more exciting or less exciting?
I got a funny thing. One time we did the Irish Hour, the trio.
Right.
And we're just sitting down waiting for them, and they said, and now here they are, the Mahoney sisters. And we're looking to see who the hell the Mahoney sisters are. The guy, you know, that's you.
That's you. DeMarco becomes Bo.
Yeah, right.
Italian becomes Irish.
Yeah, he said, we're looking, oh, there's another group on, you know, another sister act on, and honest to God.
Well, it's been a lot of fun talking to you.
Oh, same here, Dave.
And you have wonderful memories, and I look forward, if someone...
I do, and maybe we'll make some new ones.
If someone walks over to you on Saturday, it's not this Saturday, it's the 20th or 21st, I'm not sure.
I think it's the 23rd. It's
just the week before Halloween.
Yeah, are you good looking?
Well, my wife doesn't think so, but I think so.
Okay.
At any rate, if someone walks over to you and gives you a very, very gentle peck on the cheek, you'll know it's me.
All right.
Tell your husband not to punch me in the nose.
I'll tell him not to punch you in the nose.
Okay.
All right, sweetheart. Take
great speaking with you.
Mrs. What is it, Siegel?
Yes.
Let's see. I got my caller ID here. I could have called you.
No, it's all right.
914-962-3680.
That's the number.
Yeah.
That's
all right, David. God
good, and I'm sorry I couldn't send the whole tape, but at least you got some of it.
Oh, yeah. I have some tapes here from Fred Allen, but I don't have them all, you know.
Well.
You know who has them?
The Boston Library has them. Portland gave them to the Boston Library, or left them to the Boston Library.
And you know who else has the Kate Smith shows?
Who has those?
They sent me a tape there, and they charged me $22 a piece, which was well worth it, with us on, with Kate Smith. Boston University.
Oh, that's wonderful. Are they on cassettes or on open reel?
No, they're on, what are they on, Jimmy, cassettes or open reel? The Kate Smith tapes that we got. Video cassette.
Oh, video.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can bring that down. I said, we got together. I haven't got time to, you know.
Yeah. Oh,
I do want to bring you the trio with Babe Ruth.
Okay.
One more thing I'll leave you with real fast. He did a thing where they play bump bump, and he's supposed to say ball one, right?
Right.
And he kept saying ball none. I swear. And would you believe it, when we were behind him when he was doing that, and they made us leave and go to lunch, and when we came back, he was still doing it. You can see us there, sometimes they're not. And when the film comes out, you see it, it goes bump, bump, and it goes bull none. Again.
David,
it a pleasure.
Wonderful person.
Okay. Yeah.
Great talking to you.
Same here.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is Dave Siegel, OTR Fanatic, and I have the great pleasure of being able to speak with Robert Vanderventer, better known in the world of vintage radio as Bobby McGuire, Teenage Whiz Kid, Mutual's popular panel show, 20 Questions. Today's date is Tuesday, March 22nd, 1999, and Bobby has graciously offered to share some memories of the program he was featured on.
Teenage Whiz Kid. That's very interesting.
I like that.
It's so long ago that I was either a whiz kid or teenage. It's pleasant to hear the words again.
Well, your voice was very pleasant on the radio, and it certainly hasn't lost any of its tenor. I know you're writing a book about the program, and in the book you describe the inception of 20 Questions as a network program. Can you share some of those beginnings with us?
Yeah, I have in my hand my Boy Scout diary of 1945. And I shall read the entire entry for Sunday, June 10. Quote, Charles Stark played golf with us today, but it rained. We stayed up late. Exams begin in the morning. We may have a new radio show. End of entry.
How old were you when you wrote that?
Well, I was not quite 14. I was 13. Yeah.
I wonder how many 14-year-olds today keep diaries and how many of them are serious as you were at that age.
I think it grew mainly because it was one of the items you could buy from the Boy Scout quartermaster.
I see.
And once you had it, you had to kind of use it.
Terrible to leave it empty.
50 cents, yeah.
Uh-huh.
That particular diary does not mention the show again. I petered off in writing in it in the summertime and didn't take it up again. And there was no diary in 1946, so the inception of the show is strictly a matter of memory. I've always rued that because I had the diary for 1945 and 1947 and 48, but not the important year, 46. But anyway, that day was the day that's described in the piece that you read. To understand it, you really have to know who my father was. And Fred Vandeventer with the news on WOR, who had been a newsman almost all his life. He started in Tipton, Indiana, and when he was in high school, and worked for the Indianapolis Star, where he knew Earl Dare Biggers, who created Charlie
Chen.
Yeah. And then he went on to Chicago and knew Frank Knox, who was the publisher of the Chicago Daily News, and later became Secretary of the Navy, knew the prototype of the characters in the great Heck MacArthur play, The Front Page. He was the Hildy Johnson type newsman, and when the Depression came along, he had all kinds of difficulty getting a job. Finally, wound up about 1935 with the Springfield, Ohio News. I think it's now the Sun News or the New Sun, and succeeded at one of the copy desks there in the newsroom in the city desk, Scotty Rustin, who had been there for a year or two and moved on eventually, of course, to the Times, the New York Times. It isn't quite true to say that Dad took Rustin's job, because Rustin was mainly a sports writer at that time, and Dad was on a regular telegraph editor. But anyway, that was where he was when I was old enough to remember. And went from there to the Associated Press Bureau in Detroit. And when he was there, somewhere along the line, about 1940, 1941, he took an audition to be a newscaster with WJR, the Goodwill station. This was owned by G.A. Richards, who owned a string of stations around the country at that time. And in 1942, went on the air on WJR. My mother woke my sister and me up early one morning. We were ready to go to school, and here was Dad, Vandeventer, in the news. We knew that there was something in the wind, that he had taken the audition, that he was getting the job, but we really were surprised when we actually heard him. Then Elmer Davis, who was the great newscaster from Iowa and later went to head the OWI during the war, sort of created a vogue in New York, the success of the Midwestern Voice. And on account of that, WOR New York, someone like him. So they got one of Dad's transcriptions and offered him the job, and he started in October 1960 with WOR. So between that time and that next June, which I just read the diary from, he got to know, obviously, people in WOR and Mutual. And so he had a feel for the place and knew where the bodies were and who to talk to, so that when this event came up that Sunday that you read about, it was agreed that he and Stark would go ahead and talk to people to develop the show. So that was the origin of the show. If you want me to describe that day, you're better off reading that 20-page excerpt again.
Well, that will be part of your book eventually, so folks who buy your book will have the pleasure of reading that.
Yeah, of course it's fictionalized, but the facts are accurate in that excerpt.
Once the I know you indicated that you and your family were played this game of animal, vegetable, or mineral, and that was really the incentive for 20 questions. Why did they change the title from animal, vegetable, and mineral to 20 questions?
Let me explain that by just giving a brief summary of what happened that Sunday, because it was really a major coincidence that two people in the radio business having Sunday afternoon dinner were in fact having dinner in the house of a family that had always done quizzes and played parlor games, one of which was what we called animal, vegetable, or mineral. And it was suggested back and forth during the course of that afternoon that this is what you have to do to promote and produce and develop a radio program. And during the course of this, someone comes, you know, mention animal, vegetable, and mineral, as well as other part of the games we had played. And Charles Stark himself was the one who said, "I can see it now. We'll have a panel of experts playing the game, and the master of ceremonies will be the one who answers the questions. He will have the subject for you to identify, and the panel of experts will guess." And this came to his mind, and to ours, although he was the one who said it, from other panel shows, such as Information Please and the Quiz Kids. So anyway, that's how it started. So when they took it to New York and talked to Dave Driscoll, the head of news at WOR, and Norm Livingston, the head of programming, and it got talked up within the walls of 1440 Broadway, within, a month or two, it came back that, yes, people all played this, they all knew about it, but in the East, they called it 20 questions. And this was news to us. We had never, first of all, heard the term 20 questions, and secondly, we had never played with any limit on the number of questions. And so that's how the name came about. People in the East, in WOR at least, had always, who had heard of the game, who had played the game, always referred to it as 20 questions. It's kind of like the difference in its way between what you call Coca-Cola in the Midwest and what you call it in the East. Now, in the East, it's soda, but in the West, it's pop. and I guess that's the same kind of differentiation.
Right. Once the program was accepted, did Charlie Stark actually have a piece of the action?
He sued. What happened was, by... I'm guessing now, but I would say September. Now, that was in June. They started talking it up in July. The momentum started to build probably in August. And since Stark was Dad's announcer, when we would go into WOR and see him, I would always say something like, "How's the 20 questions idea coming along?" And he would always answer the same way, "We're still kicking it around." Well, finally, Dad got fed up, and he said, "We've cooked this around long enough. It's been weeks and months, and if you don't do something by Monday," or words to that effect, "I'm going to go to Bill Feinschreiber at Mutual on my own." And Stark did nothing, and so Dad went to find Schreiber, and from then on, Stark was out of it. And skipping ahead, on Saturday, February 2, when Dad did the 6:30 news, and Stark, of course, knew that the show was going on that evening at 8 o'clock, he said, "I'm suing Monday," and did. And we settled. We felt that we didn't want to fight it out. It would have been a long, drawn-out process, and I don't have any idea what the settlement was. But we agreed that certainly he had suggested the idea of the panel. We couldn't get away from that, and it was absolutely true. And all along, in fact, we kind of hoped that Stark would come back in, but no, he always stayed aloof. Didn't want any part of it. At least he didn't take any part of it. So anyway, that's what happened with Stark.
I'm not going to ask if it was a one-time settlement or got a piece of the action. Or
no, one time.
And I assume your dad actually owned the program.
Yes. When the show went on the air, Dad insisted with either Livingston or Feinschreiber, and I frankly don't know which one it was. I think it was probably a collaboration. Suggested and insisted, I should say, that however the contract was written, the actual rights to the show were going to belong to Fred and Florence Vandeventer. And they agreed. And although I have copies of some of these, not the contracts themselves, but a lot of the correspondence that went back and forth. And it certainly indicates that, yes, they are the owners of the show. However, since the contract is in force, Mutuals is actually in charge. So their ownership never really meant anything except when it was time to renew the contract.
I guess I'm getting a little ahead of myself now, but it sort of occurs to me that when we dealt with comedians like Jack Benny or others who own their programs, they got a single sum of money for the week, and from that sum of money, it was their responsibility to pay the cast. Is that the way it worked with your dad, or was everyone on salary?
No, it did later on, but not in the first contract. And I don't believe that happened until the first television contract came up. I know with a couple of the television contracts, one with Menon, one with Ronson, and one, I believe, with Dumont itself, they paid, whether it was the sponsor, they paid the whole nut, and out of that, Dad or the show paid everybody. But I don't remember which contracts that applied to. I know it did not apply to the actual WOR Mutual, which is what we're primarily interested in. The only radio.
I know I've asked you this question before, but for the record, my sense was that if you were a listener of the program at the time, in the mid to late 40s, unless you had actually read the materials put out by Mutual, publicity regarding the program, if you were just an ordinary listener and you heard the announcer talk about Fred Vandeventer, Bobby McGuire, Florence Renard, you would have thought that they were three people who had nothing to do with one another once they left the station. That Fred was the newscaster, Bobby was a very pleasant teenage young man, and Florence was, I'll be all right, was a well-known musician. Then, of course, one discovers that Fred and Florence are husband and wife, and Bobby is the young offspring. Was that accidental, or was that done with any kind of malice aforethought? Did your dad originally think it was going to be he and your mother, and hopefully you?
I think what happened was, each of us was one of whom would be a woman, one of whom would be a comedian in the sense of a wit. And the fourth of which I frankly don't remember who it was going to be. but
turned out to be a teenager.
Well, no.
You were not on the first program.
Oh, no. Well, no, let me explain. About when it was actually on the air, but rather when it was being developed. Over the fall of 1945, it was agreed certainly Dad would be on the panel. He owned the show, and it was his idea. He was the only famous one around, you see, famous at least in New York. Well, the female panel member was going to be Mary Margaret McBride, and she did two or three auditions right up into the fall, if not into the winter. I don't remember exactly which, but then sometime around December of 45, she couldn't make it. It was a last-minute cancellation, and Mother was there, and they asked her to sit in for Mary Margaret. And she did, and she did so well that Mary Margaret never came back again. But, I mean, this was nothing against Mary Margaret McBride, because she really didn't want to do it anyway. She couldn't fit it into her schedule at that time.
Pure coincidence.
She was Martha Dean, I believe. I believe she was still Martha Dean at that time, or maybe she had actually started using her own name. I frankly can't remember. But anyway, she was out and Mother was in. Well, when that happened, they decided almost perfunctorily that she wouldn't be Mrs. Vandeventer any more than Mary Livingston was Mrs. Jack Benny. She would be a separate person. And so she simply decided to use her maiden name, which of course was pronounced Reinard and not Renard, but Renard sounded more erudite. So they decided she would be Florence Renard. Well, then a month later or so, in January, somebody, I think it was Feinschreiber, decided it would be great to have a kid on the panel. Mainly, I suppose, because of the success at that very time of the Quiz Kids. Well, they didn't have any idea where to get a kid, and they called, what's his name, Golan Paul?
Yes, information, please.
Oh, no, well, that wasn't him then. It was the Quiz Kids.
Kelly.
Yeah. Well, he was the MC. I don't mean him.
Was it Cowan?
Yeah, Cowan, I believe. Anyway, the producer of the Quiz Kids said that, they got him from certain places around the Chicago schools, and they had all this, and they had a whole thing set up to screen them. And, well, that was too much work.
Couldn't get Joel Cooperman.
Yeah.
Or Kupperman.
Yeah. So finally, Dad said, we'll bring Bob in to do an audition to see how a kid looks, see how the panel looks with a kid on it. And I said, okay, I'd do it. And at the same time, that same day, I think around first week in January of 46, they brought in Herb Palazzi, who someone had recommended as a possible Oscar Levant type. He had a dry voice, and he was witty. He was a smart guy, actually.
Had he done anything else on the radio, or was this his only...
He was the producer of A Pace to Be Ignorant, and two or three other shows. Yeah, his name appears several times in John Dunning's book. And he was out of Hollywood, where he had produced movies for Bing Crosby in the late 30s. He was kind of a well-known figure around radio, but not on the upper level, not on the major Jack Benny, Bob Trout level, but he was a well-known guy.
Tom Howard knew him.
Huh?
Tom Howard would know him.
Yeah. And at the same time, at the same audition, they finally found a guy who they thought would be a good MC, Bill Slater. They had tried Paul Wing, the old spelling master, and they approached Fadiman, who didn't want any part of it. And they approached Sigmund Spaeth, the tune detective, and none of those guys did the job. So Palazzi and I and Slater all assembled with Dad and Mother at this audition first week in January. And the results of that were rather copiously described in the 20-page excerpt that I sent you.
Right.
At that time, all three of us seemed like we were in. And the live audition with a studio audience, a theater audience, was within 2 weeks. I don't remember exactly when. I agreed to do that, and then I would do the first show. And then after the first show, they would start scouting around like the Quiz Kids did to have a different teenager every week. And after the first show, they decided that was too much trouble. If I agreed, I would just stay on the panel, which is what happened.
How did your last name come up? Why did they get McGuire?
Well, the same way my mother got Renard. It was my grandmother's maiden name. I said, if you're going to be Florence Renard, I can be Bobby McGuire. I suppose I could have used the maiden name of my other grandmother, but that was Rood, R-O-O-D-E. And that didn't sound good at all.
I see.
And Bobby McGuire had a nice rhythm to it.
Okay.
So that's what it was.
And once that audition show played and the first program played, I guess they decided they weren't going to look elsewhere.
We had a little meeting on the stage after the show. We had agency people there. They all wanted transcriptions. There was no tape in those days, of course. And things looked good. It was upbeat. The show.
Now, was that first show sponsored, or was it...
No, sustaining.
Sustaining.
We had... Mutual had come up with Pageant Magazine to provide the guests, provide the prizes, and in return for which we would mention Pageant on the air, and they would win a subscription... if their subject was used.
Captain, recall who the first guest was?
Yes, Guy Lombardo.
Well, that was quite a guest.
I even remember some of the subjects that were on that first show.
He didn't bring any of the Royal Canadians with him, did he?
What happened was, he was our anniversary guest every year thereafter.
He brought you good luck.
Yeah, every February 2, or whatever show that he could fit in his schedule was closest to February 2, he was our guest again.
Okay, you said you remembered some of the questions.
Yeah, one was Robert E. Lee. One was, they're fleeting now. I remember Robert E. Lee. I got that one. That's probably why I remembered it. when I worked with a California packager for television who thought they might want to put 20 questions back on the air about 1958, I went to WR to get them a transcription of radio shows, and I got the first show, and I heard it. That's probably, you know, why it's more vivid in my memory than,
right,
than simply 55 years, but then it was lost. I never got it back, never knew what happened to it.
Did WOR keep most of the discs or transcriptions? Did your dad? Did your dad take any? Or?
They did until about 10 years ago, the time of their anniversary that we mentioned,
right,
on email,
right,
whenever that was. And the then program director told me that all of those transcriptions had been sent to the Library of Congress, or what's it, the Smithsonian? You know, I'm not sure which. I think it was the Library of Congress, and
right,
they didn't have any of them. But I never knew what was there. Of course, every show had to be recorded because it was ad lib. There was no script. And usually, in fact, after the show, I would go up to one of the control rooms, and the engineer would play it for me. While Dad was doing the 11 o'clock, his 11 o'clock news show, we would wait and go home together. And I was usually listening to the show, but...
What day of the week was the program on?
Saturday. It was always Saturday.
You didn't miss any school?
Saturday at 8 o'clock, right.
Okay. Now, you started to talk about that meeting after that first program, which obviously decided that...
So standing around on the stage,
right,
we were talking to Feinschreiber. And I can still... That's one scene I can still remember. The three of us were standing there, Dad, me, and Feinschreiber, and Dad said, shall we, keep looking for teenagers? And Feinschreiber said, no, let's just stick with Bob if he'll do it. And I said, well, you know, I'll do it, but I've got to have certain Saturday nights off for scouts, and and probably in the future for dates. I never had a date in my life up to that time. See.
However, now you could tell your girls that you were a famous celebrity. You had something to offer.
In Princeton High School, it really didn't cut much ice.
I see. Now, getting back to that unpleasant subject or pleasant subject of money, as WOR is sponsoring or Mutual is sponsoring the program, before you get a sponsor, I don't imagine that the show brought in big dollars, but how exactly was that divided?
I can tell you that. I cannot tell you what the numbers were until Ronson came aboard in July. I think it was July. It might have been June or July. Once Ronson had come aboard, we split up the three salaries in such a way as to pay the lowest taxes. And included in that, you see, was Dad's News. So Dad, for 20 questions, I think was paid $50 because all of his news shows added up to, you know, whatever hundreds it was.
Right.
And the money that I would have been, or that he would have been paid, went on to my paycheck. And mine was just about the same as Mother's. It seemed to me it was about $350 a week.
Did you get to keep any of it, or was that banked by Mom and Dad for you?
It was banked by Mom and Dad.
Good.
I got a...
Can't trust these teenagers.
I got a war bond, then a savings bond, a week. So in effect, I was making $37.50 a week.
But they didn't treat you like Jackie Cooper. Tell me something about the guests that you had over the years. You really had some extremely well-known people on the show.
Yeah.
Some well-known comedians, politicians.
Pardon?
You had comedians, politicians, musicians, educators.
We had a higher level of guests as far as academics, you might say, than most other shows that had guests. We had... some movie stars and a lot of sports figures, but we also had deans and college presidents and senators and representatives. And
any of them embarrassed by the experience, or were they all did they take everything in stride?
They were all good sports. I don't recall, in the early days at least, anybody who didn't realize, you know, it's like going in and playing basketball with the Knicks. And you just do the best you can. Some of them were better than others. Some of the wits came out with some funny stuff, and some of them never said a word. But usually, they were very interesting. They usually contributed something to the show, and some of them could really play the game. There were two that I remember that were especially good at the game. One was Ann Rutherford, and the other was Mac Carey. McDonald Carey, I believe, was on more than once, and he was pretty good. There were others who could play, maybe not that well, but not badly. And then there were some that were just totally at sea, but it was fun to hear them say so. So they were pretty good.
Now, on the occasions that you had to miss a program, either because of a Boy Scout commitment or illness, etc., who would step in for you?
Well, the first time, it was a friend of mine in school, a guy named Paul Homringhausen. His father was the dean of Princeton Theological Seminary. He was one of the brighter kids than I knew in school, and we practiced at my house two or three times. So he was, you know, he was boned up. He knew how to play. He didn't quite have the scoring spark. He just wasn't quite at home. I never did hear that show. But years later, and I mean 40 years later, when we met one time by total accident in San Francisco, I asked him, I said, how did you do in that 20 question? He said, Bob, I really messed up. He said, I had a couple of them, but I was so tongue-tied I couldn't get them out. So I didn't do the job. That, anyway, that was the first one. But then my sister took over for me three or four times. She came on as Nancy McGuire, my sister. And Nancy had all kinds of learning problems, and didn't do much at all, but she didn't embarrass anybody. I never did hear any of the shows that she was on. But obviously, if she'd completely messed up, Dad wouldn't have had her do it again. And she did at least... I went to Philmont Scout Ranch, which took me off of two shows in a row. And she did those. And then there were a couple of dates I had. And I believe she did one of those. And another one... I would have to strain my mind to remember who else filled in besides her.
Toward the end, I guess when you started to go to college or was getting ready to go to college, a fellow came in who seemed to take over for quite a while. Someone who I think you're still friendly with.
Oh, John McPhee.
Right. How did John McPhee get involved?
Well, what happened was my junior year. Known I was not going to go to a college nearby. There were people who wanted me to go to Amherst, and we went up and looked at it, and it looked all right. Then between Christmas and New Year's of my senior year in high school, which was December of 48, we took a trip south and looked at three or four colleges, including Duke. And I was overwhelmed by Duke. We had lunch with the dean of admissions, and he said, "Don't worry about getting in. You don't even have to take SATs." So I applied to Duke, and I was accepted, and that was as far as college went. So once that happened, I was summoned to New York by the president of Ronson, Mr. Harris. And in his apartment, he laid the law down. He said, "Look," he said, "I'm not going to continue to sponsor this show unless we get a replacement for the juvenile." And I said, "All right, we will do it." And
how old are you at the time?
Well, I was 17.
And you're responsible for getting your own replacement?
No. He just wanted to. I was there because he was going to talk me out of going to Duke.
Oh, I see.
And I kind of left that out. I said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Harris, I'm going to Duke." He said, "Well, then we've got to really, you know, break our backs to get a replacement." And they did. They held auditions of three or four kids each before each show, at least, I'm thinking April or May of 48. At least three or four shows. I think they looked at 15 different people from New York high schools, all recommended by the principal, and none was any good at all. They were all, you know, brains. They're probably all rocket scientists or brain surgeons now, but they couldn't play the game. Then we said, "Well, we gotta find somebody." So we started looking around Princeton, people that I knew. And the only guy that I knew that I thought had any chance at all was John McPhee. He was a year ahead of me in school, though we're the same age. He skipped a grade. And he was going to Princeton. And he was known by my family, and his family was known. We all knew each other, and John was one of my best friends, though not in my class. He wasn't in my gang. He was my best friend outside the gang. And I said, I think John can do it. We had played in the halls of Princeton High, Johnny and I. He kind of cottoned to it. He likes a challenge. He was a great athlete as well as the top scholar in his class. And at the time, he was at camp in Vermont. So we called the camp. Probably, you know, mid to late August, because I was going to leave for Duke right after Labor Day. He flew in. He was on a canoe trip, and he hiked back to the camp, got a ride to the airport, and flew into LaGuardia. I can still see him walking into the WR newsroom where we were going to meet.
With a smile on his face, I hope.
Well, kind of a smile and a quizzical look. You know, what's going on here? We all had supper at Toffanetti's. You remember that restaurant?
Oh, yes.
Had supper at Toffanetti's, and Dad laid the law down. He said, "Look, if you do this, it means every Saturday night, unless there's some major occurrence." John agreed. And he had already had an audition, and he could play almost as well as I could. And he was, his name even sounded like mine, Johnny McPhee, Bobby McGuire. His voice was
two young Irishmen.
and he did it. He started that September.
Now you did come back occasionally after that, did you not?
Well, yeah. When I was home on vacation, if they didn't have a guest, I might be the guest. And
but you didn't.
There were also times when Johnny wanted the night off, and I was home on vacation, and I would sit in for him. So I wasn't completely out of the show. And then when I came back from college, there was an interval there where we had a third juvenile who lasted, I don't know, 4 or 5 months, and during which I was picking the subjects, actually. Then I went back on. As I was 23, the world's oldest living teenager.
Did you guys get much fan mail?
Well, yes and no. You see, the fan mail almost always consisted of people sending in subjects. And the result of that was we never saw it because they had the subjects that they were suggesting. But we got over 130,000 letters a week at one time. We hired a guy named Barney O'Donnell to handle the mail and the subjects that were being suggested.
Well, that certainly shows your sponsor in the network that the people were listening.
Oh, yeah.
No doubt about that. So you're saying that most of the mail were simply people submitting questions, hoping they'd get a free Ronson.
Yeah.
Or whatever else was being offered. But
yeah, hear their name mentioned on the air.
No individual letters to Florence Bernard or to yourself or to your dad or
no,
Herb.
No, for that reason. Because there was never a letter that I ever saw that didn't have a subject being suggested.
Did all of the subjects come directly from those questions, or were some of them ringers that were decided just for the week?
They all came from letters or cards. We emphasized we wanted cards because they were easy to file. They all came from them. However, how shall I put it? It wasn't that we went through the week's cards and from them picked the subjects. Rather, we picked the subjects, and then Barney O'Donnell, the mailman, would see who had sent that subject in first. There was never a time when anybody wanted to suggest a subject to play that had not been sent in by somebody.
So you're saying, for example, if someone said Robert E. Lee, there might have been four people who said that.
Yeah.
And
400,000, more like.
Uh-huh. Did you actually...
We had a record of the first one of every subject submitted. So if we came up with a subject that had never been used, that had never been submitted, or never been thought of, and somebody decided we wanted to do that on the next week's show, Barney would say, yeah, that was first sent in by John Jones in 1946.
I can see file cards listed by topics, one file for animal, one for vegetable, one for mineral.
I don't know.
And then one for human beings. How in the world did they do that?
He had roomfuls, and they were all alphabetical by the first effective word in the phrase of whatever it was. There was cross referencing too.
Now, in addition to the four panelists, actually five panelists.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, your dad, your mom, yourself, Herb, and the guest.
Right.
And, of course, Bill Slater. How many other people were necessary to put this program together?
Well, there was the producer. His name is Gary Stevens.
I'm looking at a list here of names that appear in some of the references, and I see...
Dave, could you hold on just 1 minute? Somebody's...
Sure.
It took me about 10 seconds.
No problem.